Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUSCast. I'm your host, Grace Gotchling. On March 4th, 2020, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case June Medical Services v. Russo, which involves the constitutionality of Louisiana's law requiring physicians who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at a local hospital, and whether abortion providers can be presumed to have third-party standing to challenge health and safety regulations, such as Louisiana's admitting privileges law, on behalf of their patients. And now, to discuss the case, we have Steve Aden, Chief Legal Officer and General Counsel of Americans United for Life.
The argument was fast and furious. There was a lot of back and forth, as there often is. But I guess the first takeaway that I had was it felt like deja vu all over again. It felt like they were re-arguing the Supreme Court's case 3 years ago in a Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt, because they kept repeating the same facts that had come up in Hellerstedt. They kept making the point that the law, Act 620 in Louisiana, is substantially identical to the law that was struck down by the Supreme Court in Whole Woman's Health. So that was kind of the backdrop to the whole thing. It felt like, you know, Groundhog Day, to extend the metaphor. The conservatives had their view of the facts. The liberal side had their view of the facts, and almost never the twain would meet, at least on the merits. There was the merits and the question of standing, which was the subject of the cross petition that Louisiana brought. Both the petition and the cross petition were heard. The question of the merits and the question of standing kind of morphed into each other, as you might expect, because the question of standing had to do chiefly with whether abortion providers have a sufficiently close interest, close relationship with their patients to be able to represent their interests in federal court. So with that backdrop, what I'm just going to do is dive into a highlight reel, if you will, of the arguments. Petitioner was represented by Julie Reichelman very ably. She argued well. She started by hitting very hard June Medical's theme, which is that the case is about respect for precedent, and specifically Holman's Health versus Hellerstedt. She said Act 620 in Louisiana is identical to the statute in Whole Woman's Health, in fact, was based upon it. If 620 goes into effect, there will be one clinic in Louisiana with one abortion doctor left, and that is a substantial impact on access to abortion. She said the Fifth Circuit decision that upheld Act 620 imposed barriers on access to abortion, but allowed a statute that would not benefit women's health in any way. Repeating once again a theme from Hellerstedt. And then in terms of standing, she said the standing is waivable and in fact was waived by Louisiana. That's where Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg dove in with the first question, which related to standing. And she said, would you have done anything different if standing had been raised properly below? Reichelman said, well, the evidence was sufficient below to find there was a close enough relationship. And in fact, the law directly regulates abortion providers. And she kept reinforcing that theme that this Act 620 actually directly regulates abortion doctors. So Justice Ginsburg later, about 5 minutes later, came back to that and she said, on the cross petition, could you have joined a patient or two as plaintiffs if you had had more advanced notice of the standing issue? And Reichelman said, well, yes, it was profoundly unfair to the plaintiffs because they didn't get that opportunity, hitting the softball that Justice Ginsburg tossed to her out of the park. Then Justice Sam Alito dove in, and he took strong issue with the notion that there was a close relationship between abortion providers and the women they represent. He said, in fact, that it was, quote, amazing, unquote, if the petitioners had standing to represent their patients when it appeared to him, at least, that their interests were directly contrary. This was a health and safety law designed to protect patients from providers that operate under the standard of practice. So why would providers that allegedly operate under the standard of practice have standing to challenge those laws? And Reichelman's answer was, once again, they are directly regulated, and there are severe penalties, as she put it, on providers that don't comply. In her way of thinking, that's enough for the providers to assert the 14th Amendment rights of their patients. So Justice Alito came back and said, well, why shouldn't the patients bring suit? After all, we're talking about the right of the woman here, the abortion right of the woman. And Reichelman's answer was, yes, we are, but they have to have a doctor help them access that right to abortion. It's a little bit like the issue of, did you pay for a room? Did you pay for a room with a view? Did you pay for a room with a view of the coronation? Apparently, Reichelman is arguing that Roe and Casey provide for a right of access. And perhaps Justice Alito is alluding to Louisiana's argument that it's a right that's recognized in securing abortion that is consistent with medical practice. In other words, as the court in Roe put it, an abortion is a decision between a woman and her doctor. And then, of course, Reichelman went back to Craig versus Boren, the standing case that established standing on the part of a young man who challenged under equal protection a law that had a different age for the drinking age between men and women. They pointed out that in Craig versus Boren, the young man had actually aged out. He was over 21, so he no longer had an interest, essentially, but the court nonetheless went to the merits on the case. Later on, General Murrow from Louisiana would say, well, in her mind, that made it more of a mootness case, but I don't think that was going to fly well with the Supreme Court. She had some other better answers, I think, that I'll get back to later. But Justice Alito said that in response to Reichelman's Craig versus Boren argument, that it seems debatable that Craig versus Boren applies, and furthermore, highly debatable that Louisiana waived any assertion against standing, which is what the petitioner June Medical asserts it did. Reichelman cited to the state's concession below, J45 for the record if you're interested, where she says the state admitted that the doctors had standing to challenge Act 620. And Sam Alito came back and said, well, no, it's highly debatable that the state intended to waive that argument for all purposes in the whole case. It was within the context, the limited jurisprudential context of a TRO. They were going forward at an early part of the case. So he said, you know, it's, quote, quite a stretch, unquote, to make the argument that they waived standing. He didn't mention this, but the Fifth Circuit had said in a previous case that abortion doctors have standing. And so it's Louisiana's position that because there was circuit precedent, controlling circuit precedent establishing standing, it would have been futile to raise it below, and they appropriately raised it for the first time on the cross petition. Justice Stephen Breyer jumped in this part of the argument and later on argued rather vociferously that in order to deny standing to the doctors, you'd have to overturn precedent. And he said to Reichelman, how many abortion cases that the Supreme Court has decided had some form of third-party standing on behalf of patients? And she said, well, 8. He said, well, we're going to overrule 8 cases. Later on, he, in his inimitable style, said, well, you know, are we going to go all the way back to Marbury versus Madison? This is 40 years of precedent we have here from Singleton versus Wolf, most of the cases simply acknowledging that standing exists. And Reichelman responded once again to that softball saying by saying that the Supreme Court had specifically held standing applied in the Danforth case, also in Triplett. Carey versus Population Services involved a mail order contraceptive company that was held to have standing on behalf of its patients. At this point, the Chief Justice rather abruptly changed course to the merits, and he interjected and said, well, was the holding in Hellerstedt factual, or do results vary in terms of the Supreme Court's finding in that case that there was no benefit to the admitting privileges law? And Reichelman said, no, whole woman's health applies here. The law is identical. The burdens may vary from state to state, but there's no benefit wherever you are. Justice Kavanaugh came in and said, well, what if all the abortion doctors in a given state could get privileges. Is there still a substantial burden? She said, well, maybe not, but there's no benefit. So there's no different result in Louisiana from Texas. Between the Chief Justice and Justice Kavanaugh, they must have asked that same question probably five times. Is Hellerstedt controlling in its finding, in its holding, that there was no benefit to admitting privileges laws? At that point, Justice Alito jumped back in. He started to get into the weeds of which of these does 1 through 6 had privileges, which couldn't get them, etc., because he wanted to go apparently into the factual record, apparently attempt to distinguish Hellerstedt to some degree. He said, didn't doe number 2 decline to apply to a certain hospital because the hospital is a Catholic hospital? And Reichelman said, well, yes. How about doe number 3? Doe number 3 had privileges, right? Yes. And then he said, did the district court mention any of these facts? Apparently to him, the facts were all against the abortion providers. And she insisted, yes, it did. In fact, the abortion doctors applied to 15 different hospitals. And this colloquy between the conservatives, led principally by Justice Alito, and the liberal justices, led principally by Stephen Breyer, over the facts would continue. I mean, Stephen Breyer came back later. He said, well, look, Doe 1 was ineligible. Doe 6 was chemical abortion only. And even your Louisiana's expert said that it was unlikely she could get, or rather, he could get privileges. So he said, you know, in his usual fashion, I've gone through the entire findings and the record of the district court. All the other justices and their clerks have too. You see, which is your strongest case? This was, at this point, the argument by General Liz Murrell. And she said, well, every single one of them sabotaged their applications. Number 5 got them. Number 6 applied to only 1 out of 9 available hospitals. So you get a real strong sense that the two different sides, if you will, on abortion in the court really deeply see the facts very differently. The liberals see the facts consistently with the way the district court saw them, and the conservatives see the facts pretty consistently with the way the Fifth Circuit saw them. Going into General Murrell's argument, she started off by saying that the Fifth Circuit had, of course, correctly held that Act 620 was constitutional, that the admitting privileges law was justified by what she called life-threatening health and safety violations, medical malpractice, and a situation in Louisiana that was risky for women and substandard for doctors. Then she said, she pointed out that in terms of standing, the substantive due process argument that the doctors were making on behalf of their patients doesn't wash because, in fact, in her view, many of them did get privileges. She kept going back to her assertion that the district court just got it wrong, that there wouldn't be one clinic, one doctor doing 10,000 abortions a year, but that there would remain open at least 2 and possibly 3 abortion facilities and probably 3 abortion doctors. She said it was different from Hellerstedt. She distinguished it in terms of the law was different, the regulatory structure was different, and the facts, once again, were different. But the principal distinction she was relying on was the fact that, unlike Texas, Louisiana was imposing an admitting privileges requirement on abortion practitioners because it was trying to raise them to the same standard as other outpatient medical providers have to follow. They have ambulatory surgical center regulations. They have office practice regulations. At one point, I think it was Justice Ginsburg said, well, does this apply to office-based procedures? And in effect, she said, yes, they are consistent. They operate the same way for this kind of, this level of outpatient surgery. They require that the doctor have admitting privileges. Justice Sotomayor came in at this point. She pointed out that the state actually credentials doctors. She said, doesn't the state credential them? And if it does, why is that not enough? General Murrell responded by saying, well, apparently it's not enough, in essence, because there was a radiologist and an optometrist doing abortions. That's not within the scope of care. I think it was Justice Sotomayor who came back in and said, well, were they doing chemical abortions or were they doing surgical? And she said, well, we don't have anything in the record that indicates they were only doing chemicals, so the safe assumption they were doing surgical. Justice Sotomayor took issue with the continuity of care argument. She said, well, look, your law currently, before 620, allows an abortionist to have a contract with a doctor that has admitting privileges. You don't have to have admitting privileges yourself to do abortions. You have to just have a contract with a doctor that has them. And General Murrow's response was they didn't even comply with that emergency transfer requirement. So once again, urging that they were holding them to the same standard as others. Justice Ginsburg jumped in once again and said, you know, these hospitals in Louisiana, they require a certain number of patients that a doctor has to demonstrate they've had, a certain number of admissions into the hospital annually, and abortionists can't comply with that because abortion is, in Justice Ginsburg's view and according to the petitioners, relatively safe. And General Murrow said, well, there are courtesy privileges. One of the does got those. Justice Ginsburg said, well, could they get privileges based on a once-a-year admission, a rare emergency, in other words? And General Murrow said, well, the problem is they don't know their complication rates. They don't even track them. So there's no way of knowing what their complication rates are. We know what they've said. We know that one abortion center had 4 direct transfers to the hospital, but we don't know what the actual track record is. At that point, argument was taken up by Solicitor General Jeff Wall. He did also a very able job. He said that there should be respect for precedent, like Hellerstedt, but on the other hand, there isn't a close enough relationship here between the abortionists and their patient. And he asked, well, if you look at of the 6 Doe doctors, there is no burden on them because most of them either have or could get privileges, apparently. He said, it's very interesting. He said, this is not a factual dispute. It's not something that the district court found as a fact that bears respect and deference on the part of the appellate courts, but it has to do with the rigorousness of review. Apparently, General Wall thought that it was kind of a mixed question of fact and law that goes to the rigorousness of the review and was not a strictly factual determination whether and to what extent they could get privileges. And then Justice Ginsburg once again came in and said, but the woman is at home. She's not probably going to the same hospital that the abortionist would have admitting privileges at. What good is the statute? And General Wall's response was, well, admitting privileges requirements are common in outpatient surgery. All admitting privileges laws have some distance limits because of the continuity of care and the credentialing function. And in fact, sometimes the complications occur at the clinic. And he pointed out that Doe 3 had actually used them, as he testified. Justice Sotomayor jumped in one more time and asked an interesting question. She said, is there no woman in Louisiana, out in the country maybe, who could bring a lawsuit to challenge this law? I'm not sure that's the standard, the no woman standard, but Jeff Wall's response was, well, the issue here is that we have a for-profit provider with an interest in avoiding the kinds of regulations that drive up the price, the cost of practice, and you have women's health and safety laws, which are central to the interests of the state. Justice Breyer gave a short but rather eloquent plea for unity. In essence, he said, you know, you have people in the country, in this country, in this nation, who believe one way morally about abortion, and you have people elsewhere, principally in the cities, who maybe think that it's okay. And he said, I thought that the standing on the part of abortion doctors to challenge these kinds of laws limiting access had been established for 40 years. He said he wouldn't go back to Marbury versus Madison, he assured them. But it did seem to him that given the lack of clarity in the cases since Singleton, the lack of a firm decision, having examined a potential real conflict between practitioners and their clients, like their patients like we have in this case, that perhaps that case had not been presented yet. And finally, on rebuttal, Julie Reichelman came back up and she reiterated that there is a lack of benefits here per Hellerstedt. It doesn't change from state to state. She pointed out that the federal government recently removed its requirement for admitting privileges for certain kinds of Medicaid providers, which is true. She asserted that the admitting privileges requirement is actually more burdensome in its application than Hellerstedt. And finally, in response to what I thought was a rather oblique assertion, she said this is not a pre-enforcement challenge. If you seem to be angling toward the argument that this is not facial but rather as applied, for obvious reasons, after Gonzalez versus Carhart and the Hellerstedt decision, she said, well, you know, this went into effect. It's not a pre-enforcement challenge. We have some idea of the impact it will have. And with that, she wrapped up. In closing, I really felt that the two sides of the court had two very different views of the facts on the merits, the question of the benefit of admitting privileges laws. And in terms of standing, you had one side of the court that I think was quite willing to accept June Medical's assertion that because there's an impact on the providers themselves, that's sufficient. And perhaps the other side, the conservatives, wanting more than that, wanting there to be some kind of showing that there's a close relationship and not seeing that here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.